And I'd never done anything at Hampstead. And it was Ed Hall. Never heard of the play, never heard of Martina.
Yeah.
And I got the play and I thought, well, I'll read it. And I don't think, you know, this is the next thing because I really want to do a film. I started reading it, and I started reading it. I couldn't put it down. And I didn't, I didn't know why.
Yeah.
And that's a strange thing to have about a play, because the play doesn't really explain itself.
I actually had a similar response when I, when you told me you wanted to discuss this speech. And for people who don't know the play, it's the prologue, isn't it? It's the opening speech. So actually,
the opening speech,
I thought, well, okay, I can, you know, I don't need to read the whole play to understand this. It's the first thing we see of the play. So, you know, I'll sit down and read the prologue, make sure that I know what Adrian and I are chatting about. And I had exactly the same experience. I sort of got to the end of the prologue, having printed it out. And I was like, I want to know what happens next. I ended up opening up the PDF on my computer again and being like, okay. And reading sort of the first half of the play, because it just had this flow.
I'm just making a few notes here so I don't go off into actor anecdote, because I will.
Oh, please.
I have to make notes.
Actor anecdote is exactly what we want.
To keep myself.
Do not censor yourself, Adrian. This is not the place.
Okay. It's a four-hander. The cast was Emily Barber, Jack Hunter, who has cerebral palsy and was a wheelchair user in the play, although not in life, he isn't. And Katie Sullivan, who is an actress, and she actually is an Olympian as well.
I read this. I was like, that is rude. That's just rude. That's to just be rude. A brilliant actress and a Paralympian.
And a Paralympian. But the way that people would talk, that they would speak about, you know, people, you know, one attitude on the phone, and then when they meet you, they've got this other attitude, and you can see them going into what I would describe as sometimes race panic, where people sort of said, they've said something and their eyes go wide and they go, oh God, I hope we didn't hear that. When I said dark, I meant mood, not actually. And they have the same thing when they're sort of meeting someone and they sort of flick and look at their body and go, oh, I'm not going to mention it. Oh, it's there. Yeah, oh, what do I do? You suddenly become aware in using language of just how language has been constructed with one point of view in mind. Not only like when I do a job, I have to, and I say it's a classical text. You don't have to read very far into the classical text before you come to a bump of color where black is just negative and bad and horrible. And you go, I understand it and it's all, you know, fine. And that's what we used to say. But now when we know much more about our world and our world looks very, very different, it kind of pings out at you.
Absolutely.
And such is the same when talking to Katie, and you just have to, you know, just run around with it for a bit, you know, when you just have to get it on its legs and just try and, you know, it's all these little phrases we use without using physicality to describe a mood or a feeling, rather than, you know, being more specific with our words. It's a strange thing to discover.
So why this speech? What is so magical about this speech? Because I feel like actually when you read the prologue, I wasn't aware at that point that this was a play that was going to focus actually on disability versus able-bodied people.
Yeah.
Or caring. Yeah. That none of that comes up in this prologue, does it?
No, it doesn't. Okay, for firstly, why the prologue? The prologue sticks out in my mind because it is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 7 pages. And I would every night, I would just get these butterflies in my stomach as I was just preparing to go on.
I wanted to ask that. I was going to ask, was it nerve-wracking?
It was nerve-wracking. And I love those little bits of our job where you get tested. The play flips backwards and forwards in time. So at that point, his wife is dead. Arnie, his wife is dead. He is mourning her. He... He's going to tell people the story of, you know, how it happened and why he feels so sad. But there's a note that Martina writes in the at the beginning of the play. She says, self-pity is not a currency for these people. Self-pity is the worst thing. Humor is the best thing. So Eddie is incredibly sad. He's incredibly lonely. He's a recovering alcoholic. And he's desperate for a drink. He's desperate for company, and he misses his wife so much, and he feels incredibly alone. But the last thing he does in that speech is mention it. He doesn't want to say, I feel lonely. I miss my wife. Will you please talk to me and help me? Because I don't think I'm going to last very long. He doesn't say any of that. It's like everything that he doesn't say is the most important thing.
Yeah. So just to clarify, at the sort of at the beginning of the timeline, at least that the play portrays, Arnie and Eddie have separated, and actually the character of Eddie only goes back to care for her because she's had an accident. And he feels he is the best person to be her carer. Is that right?
Yeah, that's how he explains it to her.
Right.
But actually he loves her and he misses her.
Yeah.
He doesn't, again, in the play, he doesn't say it. He just says, but look, who else is going to look after you? He says, I got my nurse, I got my things, I got my, you know, I don't need you. And you're in the audience, you're sitting there thinking, yes, you do. You desperately need him and he desperately needs you.
What about this opening speech? Was it just the, you know, you've already mentioned this thing that it's sort of 7 or 8 pages long.
Yeah.
It can't be just the length of it that was intimidating because, as you say, you've played, I mean, well, the Peterbrook Hamlet, you know, is a longer period of time alone on a stage, surely.
Yeah, it is,
So what was it about it that gave you the jitters?
It sounds so simplistic to say getting it right. Just getting it right. I had to kickstart the play and make sure the audience got all the information they needed to understand the play from the mouth of a guy who doesn't express half of what he's feeling. At some audiences, you walk out and you look at them and you begin to chat and they just get scared. They go, they see it and go, no, he's talking to me.
Yeah, you can see it. Yeah.
He's going to make fun of one of us. One of us is going on stage. Something bad's going to happen. And
I'm going to be chopped in half.
And people get fearful. You know, any comedian will tell you the same thing, that people just sort of go back, oh, no, he's going to pick on us. Oh, no.
Yeah.
You have to sort of say, no, we're going to have a good time. It's going to be fine. And there were some nights where I came out and I began and the audience would right there, leaning forward, listening to every single word. And you could tell, when I hit a conclusion of a thought, there would be this little action, a little intake of breath, or a little something that just said, "Oh, you're really listening to everything I say." So this is going to be easier today.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me when I was reading the prologue was the extent to which Martina uses punctuation or not, and line breaks. Like it's very, like, to see this prologue on the page, it looks like a poem almost.
Yeah.
You know, she shifts lines so frequently. How did you find that? Did it feel like a real sort of guiding hand?
It was terrible. because you mentioned poetry, but just like poetry, it's a lot of disjointed thoughts.
Yeah.
And non sequiturs just following on from each other. So I had to... Oh, this is going to sound so terrible. I had to learn the music of it, if you know what I mean. Rather than the beautifully written progressive lines of thought, you know, every thought completed before moving on to the next one.
Yeah.
He speaks just like, you know, you do in real life, I suppose. He'll set up a clause. He'll go, I mean, the first time I was on the bus, it was terrible because, you know, see, I like to go for a walk. and you're just going, what about the bus, man? We'll finish the bus. Yeah. So I had to look, I put this speech in my headphones. I read it through and put it in my headphones. And I had it playing, you know, daily for about a week. 2 weeks before we started rehearsals, so that by the time I walked into rehearsals, that this speech was learnt.
Yes.
I didn't want to spend any rehearsal time trying to learn the lines. I grew a beard.
Right.
And let my hair grow for the part. And then I had to go and do a reshoot on a part that I'd done previously, which was sort of like, I think about a week before the end of the run. And so I go off and I have my hair completely cut and tidied and sharpened up. I go completely clean shaven. And then I come back to continue the run. And it just felt wrong.
Yeah.
Katie took one look at me and went, this is weird.
That's not him. Yeah.
Because I thought it actually felt really bad because I looked like someone who'd got up and shaved that morning and had tidied their hair and really took care of their appearance. And that just isn't the guy.
No.
It broke the reality of it. for a bit. So anybody who saw that performance, I apologize for my lack of hair, but I hope you still got the play. It's a beautifully written speech, and it's one that I you know, it's a part that I was so lucky to play.